Thank you, Professor Chung. Thank you for the honour and the kind words that you have said to introduce me. Colleagues, friends, excuse me, my presentation is going to be in English. It will be helped, I hope, not hindered somewhat. I've prepared a translation in French, an experimental translation, but hopefully the main ideas will not be too obscured. The talk is quite wide-ranging. I hope you don't go to sleep too early, but it touches upon, I believe, some important issues in contemporary Chinese thought, in a very broad sense, including political thought. I'm going to start with a little bit of historical background, recent historical background in Taiwan. The late 1970s and 80s witnessed the growth of an influential movement in Taiwan and Hong Kong. This movement sought to sinicize or indigenize the social sciences, in particular social psychology, anthropology and sociology. The movement promoted a return to the cultural roots of being Chinese and the development of sinicized social and behavioural science approaches to research. In Taiwan, the indigenisation process began under the name of Zhongguohua, sinicisation, because in the social sciences, China was regarded as the local during the 1980s, particularly the first half of the 1980s. The term Bentuhua, localisation, was also adopted to refer to this same idea. By and large, the term Zhongguohua represented the claim that the social sciences, or particular social science disciplines, should be grounded in local, regional, culture, experience, and perspectives. In this context, the local or regional variously referred to a somewhat vague notion of China, or Chinese society, including Taiwan, or to particular Huaren Sinitic societies, or to Taiwan itself. The basic theme of this movement was that Chinese social scientists should be self-conscious, self-critical, and independent, that is, not subordinated to the West, so as to contribute to making the world's social science disciplines more cosmopolitan and globalized through proper acknowledgement being afforded to national and cultural particularities. By the mid-1980s, however, the term indigenization, this bentuhua, in the cultural and political arenas came to refer to the process of Taiwanization. With the end of martial law and the removal of press restrictions in 1987, as well as the emergence of Taiwanese cultural nationalism that same decade, renewed interest in Taiwanese history and culture began to consolidate and assert itself both in both intellectual and popular discourse. The Kuomintang, the nationalist party's 1991 abandonment of its claim to be the legitimate government of all China and the implementation of a democratic electoral system at the national level legitimized political and intellectual interest in Taiwan identity. Sinification gradually lost favour in Taiwan during the 1990s as a consequence of the changing political landscape. But during that same period, the terms sinicization and indigenization both found support among anthropologists and psychologists on mainland China. It was also in the 1990s that a similar trend became embedded in the field of Chinese philosophy, in mainland China in particular, and not just mainland China, but also Hong Kong. However, unlike the sinicization movement in 1970s and 1980s Taiwan, in 1990s mainland China, the goal of recognizing the local was not subordinated to that of introducing a Chinese voice into the discipline of philosophy in order to make the discipline more global and more cosmopolitan, and thereby reinforcing the discipline's universalist claims. Rather, the case of Chinese philosophy emerged as a response to the perceived threat that the universalist claims of theory posed to the particularity of local cultural identity. A watershed in this process of development occurred in the early years of the new millennium with the so-called legitimacy of Chinese philosophy debate. This 中国哲学合法性. Many Chinese academics argued that Western philosophy had yet to acknowledge the legitimacy of Chinese philosophy, to engage Chinese philosophy as an equal partner in dialogue. Others further insisted that the articulation and the development of China's philosophical heritage must draw exclusively on the paradigms and norms of China's indigenous tradition, and that paradigms and norms that had been derived from the West in particular are not only inappropriate, but also hegemonic and or ill-suited to China's national conditions. For example, writing in 2009, Hong Kong philosopher Xin Guanglai insisted that it is by studying Chinese ethical thought on its own terms that we can bring out its more distinctive ideas, which can then be fleshed out and developed without being shaped by agendas set by Western philosophical discussions. Xun drew attention to the consequences of the modern default practice of using Western concepts and frameworks for doing comparative work between Chinese and Western philosophies. He points out, while we see frequent deployment of Western philosophical frameworks in the study of Chinese thought, we rarely encounter the reverse phenomenon, namely the deployment of Chinese philosophical frameworks in the study of Western thought. He continues, we see engaged discussions of such questions as whether Mozi is a utilitarian, but not whether John Stuart Mill is a Maoist or endorses Jian Ai. We find debates about whether traditional Chinese thought has a conception of rights, but not whether Western traditions have a conception of Li. And more recently, we see debates about whether Confucian ethics is a form of virtue ethics, but not whether Aristotelian ethics is a form of Li Xue. Now, support for these kinds of concerns was, in turn, bolstered by a robust, a strong Confucian-centered Chinese cultural nationalism. Confucian-centered Chinese cultural nationalism is a movement based on the ideological conviction that Confucianism is a cultural identity integral to the identity consciousness of the Chinese people, the Zhonghua nation. Similar views were also raised in the context of the Guoxue Re, or national learning fad, that also peaked at the end of the first millennium, first decade of the new millennium, 9 years ago. Although definitions of Guoxue, national studies, vary often considerably, most Chinese scholars favor a broad definition, usually along the lines of a generic term for traditional Chinese culture, traditional Chinese scholarship or research on Chinese culture. A major figure in instigating both the legitimacy of Chinese philosophy debate and reviving Guoxue national studies is Chen Lai. Professor Chen is currently professor of philosophy at Tsinghua University and dean of Tsinghua University's Guoxue Yuan, which goes by the English translation of Academy of Chinese Learning. In an influential article published in the Guangming Daily in 2010, he wrote, historians long ago pointed out that China's several thousand years of unbroken historical record is unique in the world. The principles informing all social sciences must be subjected to and validated by the test of China's historical experience before their veracity can be proven. That's quite a strong claim. The national learning fad helps people to reflect critically on the standpoint from which Western culture takes the particular to be the universal, to reflect critically on the importation or transplantation of Western systems of learning, and by taking due account of China's experience and China's wisdom, establish a subjectivity for Chinese culture and promote the equal exchange of the world's many cultures. Other protagonists at the time also expressed concerns about the effects of Western systems of learning in China. For example, Some worried that because Chinese classical studies being an integral part of national learning, of Guoxue, has been reduced to particular disciplines such as philosophy, philology, history, or anthropology, this has led to the methodological confusion. This has led to methodological confusion and impeded true understanding. Others despaired that the Western system of academic disciplines has led to the breaking up and fragmentation of China's traditional learning. Because of this, Guoxue cannot exist and develop as an organic whole. This is one of the messages that's constantly repeated, that Guoxue is organic. It cannot be broken apart. Consequently, it is difficult to guarantee that China's traditional learning and culture can exert a strong influence among the world's national cultures. Still others complained that traditional bodies of learning associated with the bibliographic taxonomy of the four divisions, the Sibu, classics, histories, philosophers, and collected writings, have not only each been subjected to dislocation, but the knowledge contained in each has been mere material, fodder, for disciplines introduced from the West. Since then, complaints about Western cultural imperialism have not been the concern of academics alone. Concerns about the cultural particularity of so-called universal values have also become a major issue for China's leaders. Consistent with its growing economic, political, and military might, China wants due recognition by an engagement with the global community of nations. This aspiration is complicated by the fact that China's political leaders and intellectuals continue to struggle with how Chinese values fit with universal values and global institutions, and whether there is a single global modernity, one perhaps China can shape, or whether there are multiple modernities and multiple, perhaps competitive, universal values. In the wake of the PRC, the People's Republic of China, leadership transition to President Xi Jinping in mid-November 2012, the party state's hostility to universal values notably increased. This shift was most evident when Liu Qiba became the head of the publicity department, which oversees propaganda. Early in 2013, a notice was sent to universities about seven prohibited discussions, Qibujiang. Universal values was at the top of the list of prohibited discussions. Today, there remains significant reticence about discussing this topic openly. President Xi Jinping's most important speech on universal values was given at the Central Party School at the end of 2015, in which he berated foreign powers for using Western universal values to subvert China's socialist ideology. He stated, and I quote, "Within and beyond the nation, various antagonistic powers are always trying to undermine what our party stands for. Most damagingly, they plot to get us to cast aside our faith in Marxism and discard our belief in socialism and communism. And even some of our comrades within the party, who haven't clearly perceived the hidden agenda therein, think that since Western universal values have endured for several centuries, why shouldn't we identify with them? What's wrong with borrowing some Western political discourse? It won't bring any great harm. These people thus unwittingly become a cheer squad for capitalist ideology." In going on to address the topic of strengthening the party's work on theoretical education, Xi Jinping stressed the need for party educators to provide clear guidance to students in the Central Party School about the proper way to understand the following issues. For example, the scientific nature of socialism with Chinese characteristics, strengthening and improving party leadership, the scientific content of the values of freedom, democracy, and equality, and, separately, what in the West are called universal values. Now, it might seem incongruous that values such as freedom, democracy, and equality are distinguished from what Xi Jinping here refers to as what in the West are called universal values. Here, we need to bear in mind that already early in 2014, the party's ideological authorities had proclaimed a set of core socialist values. It's in three tiers. So we have national values, prosperity, democracy, civility, harmony, social values, freedom, equality, justice, rule of law, individual values, patriotism, dedication, integrity, and friendship. And the party went to great lengths to disseminate, and it continues to go to great length, to propagandise these values, even to the extent of organising dance troupes to sing the praises of core socialist values. And we have graphic representations of these blossoming core socialist values. Collectively, the 12 values are obviously a mix of past and present, local and global conceptual ingredients. Strangely, however, there is quite literally no hint of just what foundation this motley set of values is rooted in. What is clear from Xi Jinping's comments, however, is that freedom, democracy, and equality are not to be identified with their Western namesakes. Despite the explicit criticisms of universal values, some prominent Chinese academics have not only managed to navigate these dangerous political waters, but have also accrued significant political capital in the process. Chen Lai, who I introduced a short while ago, is perhaps the most prominent example. As already noted, Chen Lai is professor of philosophy at Tsinghua University and dean of Tsinghua University's Guoxueyuan, its national studies institute or academy. He is widely regarded as the foremost specialist of Confucian philosophy in China. Last year, he was also appointed as a member of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, a national legislative advisory body in the People's Republic of China. This appointment is a strong endorsement by the party of Professor Chen Lai and also of his approach to the issue of universal and particular values. In an insightful recent article, the American intellectual historian Hoyt Tillman writes, "In the current political climate, where Chinese particularistic values are lauded and universal values are highly suspect, it is impressive that Chen Lai has set forth a synthesis of Confucianism and Marxism in terms of their projected universalities. For example, his portrayal of freedom, equality, and justice as universally desired goals or values is grounded in his own account of Confucian moral values. Therefore, he's able to propose his case for linking these three values to the political ends of Chinese socialism and the common good of society, rather than through liberal Western discourse on rights." Besides approving of Chen Lai's 2014 book, Renxue Benti Lun, Humaneness Based Ontology, authorities have reportedly praised Chen Lai's approach to discussing universal values. According to Tillman, the party-controlled media's embrace of his recent books and articles reinforces the impression that despite its sensitivity to and policies against universal values, the Chinese Communist Party still includes members who are not totally opposed to the universal significance of values, but are anxious to redefine those values to accord not only with Chinese tradition, as Chen has done, but also to be compatible to the conditions deemed necessary for continued political control. Chen Lai is an expert on Neo-Confucian philosophy of the Sung and Ming periods. His self-styled humaneness-based ontology, this Renxue Benti Lun, is a sophisticated attempt to develop a new ontology, drawing inspiration from a range of thinkers, including the great Neo-Confucian thinker Zhu Xi. One of Chen's more creative appropriations of Zhu Xi's thought concerns Juicy's account of the unity of the virtues, in which one cardinal virtue, that of humaneness, is foundational for a group of other cardinal virtues. Specifically, these cardinal virtues are the four that classical philosopher Mencius, Mengzi, first clustered as a group. Humaneness, Ren, doing what is just and one's duty, Yi, behaving with decorum, Li, and wisdom, Zhi. What is distinctive in Juxi's account of the unity of these virtues is that humaneness is presented as sustaining and giving rise to the other three virtues. Chen Lai's creative appropriation was to adapt Juxi's strategy and make humaneness the foundation not only of other Confucian virtues, but also of the universal values of freedom, equality, and justice. Chen further seeks to persuade the reader that these three universal values are a legacy of the Chinese Confucian tradition and thus not simply an import from the West. As Tillman notes, this resulting synthesis of values is presented as having advantages over Western programs of universal values. On the one hand, Chen Lai wants to insist that China's concept of humaneness, Ren, can embrace the global because the Chinese concept of humaneness is the essential foundation of all values. On the other hand, he seeks to reject claims that the Western universalistic value of democracy should apply to China. In a 2015 article in Renmin Ribao, Chen Lai wrote, "In discussing the particular characteristics of the values of Chinese civilization, the Zhonghua Wenming, we cannot attend only to the moral concepts of Chinese culture, but must take Western culture as a comparator, in particular, the values of modern Western culture, in order to discern the particular characteristics of the values of Chinese civilization. When compared to modern Western values, there are four particular characteristics of the values of Chinese civilization." Responsibility comes before freedom. Duty comes before rights. The social group comes before the individual person, and harmony is superior to conflict. In Western culture and Western values, there is a conflict mentality that always seeks to use its own power and take a self-centered stance to overcome, control, and to dominate others. Because of this, religious wars throughout Western history are extremely brutal. In contrast, China has never experienced such religious wars. It can indeed be said that the cultural origins of the 20th century's two world wars do not lie in the East. Overall, it could be said that when compared to Western culture and Western values, Chinese culture and Chinese values emphasize harmony over conflict. Instead of demonstrating how such values of liberty, equality, and justice are actualized or evident in policies and institutions of the PRC, the People's Republic, Chen Lai uses the Singapore model of Asian values to implicitly support his case that the Chinese value system can encompass such modern values. He further insists that the core Asian values are Confucian. In 2015, Chen Lai published the volume The Core Values of Chinese Civilization. In an appendix to that volume, Chen wrote, "Are there new universal values that have been brought forth out of Confucianism itself, values that differ from liberal democratic ones? I think there are. In today's world, the most influential ones are undoubtedly what Singapore has called Asian values. Asian values include five main values. First, the state is more important than the individual. Second, the roots of the state are in the family. Third, the state must respect the individual. Fourth, harmony is better than conflict at maintaining social order. And fifth, there must be peaceful coexistence between religions." I think, this is Chen Lai continuing, "I think that if I were to look at this topic of new universal values, I would naturally think of the example of Singapore. These five principles not only include traditional East Asian values, they also include new values that have been absorbed from Western civilization over the past century, such as the one stipulating that the state must respect the individual. Actually, Singapore's set of Asian values is a systematic set of values that does not give priority to individualism. This is Singapore's version of modern Asian values. And I think this is also Singapore's version of the values of modern Confucian civilization, the core of which is not the priority of the individual's right of freedom, but the good of society and the community. Now, I note in passing that Chen Lai made almost exactly the same comments as far back as 1998. As with Chen Lai, a number of prominent Western scholars who work in the field of Chinese philosophy have also been critical of values that are based on the notion of the atomic individual. In particular, the positions taken by North American comparative philosophers Roger Ames and Daniel Bell have lent considerable ballast, considerable support to the agenda of philosophers such as Chen Lai. I also note that both Ames and Bell now work and for some years have worked in universities in China. Ames objects to forms of Western ethical theorizing such as virtue ethics in which the individual is the focus. He argues that the language of virtue ethics, which appeals to the vocabulary of agents, acts, generic virtues, character traits, autonomy, motivation, reasons, choice, freedom, principles, consequences, and so on, introduces distinctions that assume a foundational individualism as its starting point. With deep roots in the classical Greek philosophical narrative, he insists that individualism has become a default common sense assumption, if not indeed an ideology. He further argues that it has garnered a monopoly on human consciousness without any serious alternative to challenge it. Instead, he proposes what he calls Confucian role ethics. This is his project. Arguing that it provides a better ethical model. At the heart of Confucian role ethics is, and I quote, a specific vision of human beings as relational persons constituted by the roles they live rather than as individual selves. Ames provides the following illustration. Ames is an American, so his English is at times somewhat creative. Confucian normativity is defined by living one's family roles to maximum effect. Lived family roles, mothering, brothering, granddaughtering, are themselves normative standards that, informed as they are by existential embodiment, are much clearer and more concrete than putative moral principles. This critique of ethical models in which the individual is the fundamental unit is also a key element in the utopian political, a key element in the utopian political order proposed by influential international relations theorist Zhao Tingyang. I am, of course, referring to his Tianxia or All Under Heaven model. Historian Wang Gengwu describes the traditional concept of Tianxia as an abstract notion embodying the idea of superior moral authority that guided behavior in a civilized world. It depicts an enlightened realm that Confucian thinkers and Mandarins raised to one of universal values used to determine who was civilized and who was not. In his own vision of Tianxia, Zhao Tingyang describes the place of the individual as follows. All under heaven takes the whole world as a single political system that is much greater and higher than a single country or nation state. The Chinese system of families, states, and all under heaven, which differs fundamentally from the Western system of individuals, nations, and internationals, is often criticized for its neglect of the individual as well as individual rights, but this is a misunderstanding. There is no Chinese denial of the value of the individual, but rather a denial of the individual to be a political foundation or starting point, because the political makes sense only when it deals with relations rather than individuals. And the political is meant to speak for coexistence rather than single existence. Another influential political theorist who takes a similar stance to Ames and to Zhao Tingyang, on the status of the individual is Daniel Bell. Bell is Dean of the School of Political Science and Public Administration at Shandong University, which is quite a unique situation to have a foreigner holding such a powerful academic position in China. In his earlier work, Beyond Liberal Democracy, Political Thinking for an East Asian Context, Bell criticised liberal democracy and the shortcomings of liberal individualism. In his recent and more widely discussed book, The China Model, Political Meritocracy and the Limits of Democracy, Bell's target is electoral democracy and what he calls the tyranny of the majority. For Bell, the danger of electoral democracy is that irrational and self-interested majorities acting through the democratic process can use their power to oppress minorities and enact bad policies. Sound familiar? In contrast, he argues, the virtue of political meritocracy is that examinations that test for voter competence can help to remedy this flaw. As with Chen Lai, Bell also promotes Singapore's political meritocracy as a viable alternative to electoral democracy. As for China, he writes, the leading political idea in China, widely shared by government officials, reformers, intellectuals, and the people at large, is what I call vertical democratic meritocracy, meaning democracy at the lower levels of government, with the political system becoming progressively more meritocratic at the higher levels of government. Bell, of course, has no shortage of detractors, of critics. He's been criticised for offering little evidence of meritocracy at work and no more than a theoretical argument in its defence. Others attack him for presenting a fictional China as a rhetorical platform from which to continue a long-standing debate internal to Western political thought, the debate between communitarianism and liberal democracy. Despite these and many other criticisms, his status as a public intellectual of some note in China has in no way been tarnished. As with Chen Lai, over the past decade, a group of younger academics based at various universities in China has also been arguing for the priority of the nation over the individual. This group has also become known informally as the Kung Clique, the Kungdung. And I believe our colleague, our distinguished colleague, Professor Peter Zarrow, gave a talk on the figure of Kung Youwei just a couple of days ago. So I'll be very careful what I say. Several prominent figures associated with the Kung Clique were also participants in a workshop held at East China Normal University in Shanghai in 2011. The transcripts of discussions from the workshop were published 2 years after that under the title, What is Universal? Whose Values? Contemporary Confucians Discuss Universal Values. The name Kung Clique derives from the call by some of its members, such as Chen Ming and Gan Chunsung, to return to Kung Youwei, Hui Dao Kung Youwei. Kung Youwei was a major intellectual and reformer active in the transition between the Qing Empire and the establishment of Republican China in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. For many Confucian revivalists today, particularly those who self-consciously identified as so-called mainland New Confucians, Da Lu Xin Lu Jia, Kung had proposed a superior blueprint for nation building and state building at a critical juncture in China's history as it moved from being an empire to a nation state. Chen Ming, for example, writes that in Kung Youwei's blueprint, the integrity of the nation and maintenance of the people's livelihood historically took priority over individual rights, constitutional democracy, freedom of belief, and other value priorities of the Enlightenment project. Here, Enlightenment project refers to the liberal intellectual tradition in modern China. Chen laments that ultimately Kung's vision was hijacked by the agenda set by liberal intellectuals. He continues, the Enlightenment project and its utopian narrative should have been chosen only if they could have served as a program for salvation. We should not and cannot allow theory to swallow up facts or means to become ends. But most unfortunately, this is where our biggest problems are today. In other words, the utopian visions of Chinese liberals continue to block Kanye West's blueprint from being realized, as far as Chen and his colleagues are concerned. For Confucian revivalists such as Chen Ming, a key element in Kang's blueprint was a proposal to make Confucianism the state religion. And this is something that Chen Ming and his colleagues continue to argue for today. They want to see Confucianism returned as the state religion. Kang is also relevant to the topic of Tianxia that we talked about a little while ago. Kang was associated with a lineage of Confucian scholarship known as New Text Confucianism, and Professor Cheng is an authority on New Text Confucianism. So again, I'll be careful what I say. New Text Confucianism has its origins in the Han Dynasty, but was revived and completely reinterpreted in the 19th century. One of the key features of New Text Confucianism is its emphasis on a cyclical view of history characterized by a three-stage periodization. Kang Youwei transformed this cyclical model into a teleological model of three-stage progress, which culminates in the utopian vision of an age of universal peace or great unity. As with Chen Lai, Kang attached a particular high importance to the moral ideal of Ren. For Kang, Ren represents a metaphysical worldview, a moral ideal or value pattern that's built into the structure of reality. So reality is morally hardwired. Furthermore, Kang's understanding of the moral ideal of Ren was teleological. He projected the full realization of Ren to a distant but definite point in the future, the age of universal peace or great unity. His vision, Kang's vision of this great unity, amounted to an all-inclusive universal society with no place for territorial states, for the territorial state. As a utopian commonwealth, it is not unlike Zhao Tingyang's vision for his so-called Tianxia system. Another prominent Chinese public intellectual who has been active in promoting the concept of Tianxia as an inclusive political institution that transcends nation states and nationalism is the Shanghai-based academic Xu Jilin. In contrast to the Kang clique, Xu is strongly opposed to nationalism. Xu maintains that nationalism can lead to horrific large-scale violence such as the two world wars. As with Zhao Tingyang, his antidote to nationalism is what he calls the new Tianxia or new all under heaven. Xu Jilin describes Tianxia in traditional China as a world spatial imaginary with China's central planes at its core, and claims that the values of this civilizational tradition were universal and humanistic rather than particular and unique to one civilization or one culture. Xu maintains that behind the traditional Chinese empire was a Tianxia consciousness for all humanity, a set of universal values that transcended the particular interests of any given dynasty. Their source was the moral way of heaven. These values served as the standard for determining right and wrong throughout all under heaven, constrained the behavior of rulers, and determined the legitimacy of a given dynasty's rule. He then makes the following comments about post-Tianxia China, that is, China over the last 100 years. He says, an empire without Tianxia consciousness means that the imperial body no longer possesses a soul with universal values and a civilization that puts people at ease. In its place, there is nothing but the calculation of the nation-state's self-interest. Yet, if traditional Tianxia were so cosmopolitan and universal, how does Xu Jilin explain the age-old distinction between barbarians and Chinese? A distinction that has been a consistent hallmark of the notion of Tianxia. You can't have Tianxia without this distinction. While acknowledging that people in pre-modern China spoke not just of Tianxia, but also of the difference between barbarians and Chinese, Xu insists that in early China, notions of Chinese and barbarian were completely different from the dichotomies of China and the West and us and them that today's extreme nationalists are always talking about. That which determined the distinction between barbarian and Chinese was solely whether or not a civilization was associated with the values of Tianxia. Whereas Tianxia was absolute, the categories of barbarian and Chinese were relative. Whereas blood and race were innate and unchangeable, civilization could be studied and emulated. He further claims that in traditional China, Tianxia did not belong to one particular race or country. Despite Xu Jilin's reputation as a liberal public intellectual, strongly opposed to nationalism, some of his discussion of China as a civilizational power invites some questions about his vision for a so-called new Tianxia. If China's goal is not to stop with the construction of the nation state, but rather to re-establish itself as a civilizational power with great influence in global affairs, then its every word and deed must take universal civilization as its point of departure. And in global dialogue, it must have its own unique understanding of universal civilization. As a great power with global influence, what China must now realize is not just the dream of rejuvenating the nation and the state, but also the reorientation of its national spirit toward the world. What China needs to reconstruct is not a particularistic culture suited to one country and one people, but a civilization that has universal value for all humanity. Values that are good for China, particularly the core values that concern our shared human nature, should in the same way be good for all humanity. The message here is mixed. On the one hand, Xu calls for the reconstruction of values that have universal significance for all humanity and not just one culture or society. On the other hand, this aspiration seems to be fundamentally compromised by his other claim that due to China's own unique understanding of universal civilization, which in turn is grounded in China's pre-modern tradition of Tianxia, then China should seek to re-establish itself as a civilizational power with great influence in global affairs and reconstruct a civilization that has universal value for all humanity. Xu supports his claim that China is well prepared to re-establish itself as a civilizational power by invoking American political scientist Lucien Pai's well-known aphorism that China is a civilization pretending to be a nation state. Xu further reinforces this sense of historical destiny by then claiming that China is a world power. As a nation of the world that bears Hegel's world spirit, it is only appropriate that it takes responsibility for the world and for the world spirit it has inherited. The world spirit is the new Tianxia that will emerge in the form of universal values. Xu asserts that values that are good for China, particularly the core values that concern our shared human nature, should in the same way be good for all humanity. Yet, is the import of this claim, the significance of this claim, really so very different from that conveyed by Chen Lai's assertion that humaneness is the foundation not only of Confucian values, but also of the universal values of freedom, equality, and justice? After all, from a Confucian perspective, humaneness is an innate quality of our common human nature. And so, ipso facto, it must be good for all humanity. Indeed, despite the appeal to universal values in Xu Jilin's notion of new Tianxia, it seems that it is Confucianism alone that is presented as the authority for determining which values constitute core values. He explains that historically, the greatness of Confucianism came from its capacity to transcend the interests of the individual and the dynasty. Today, being above the state, Confucianism possesses the universal values of Tianxia. By insisting that values that are good for China should in the same way be good for all humanity, Xu is making a case for expanding the range of universal values, but in a way that privileges Confucian values. China's proponents of Tianxia are not without their critics. One of the most prominent is historian Ge Zhaoguang of Fudan University. He comments as follows. In recent years, some Chinese scholars have felt that as China begins its rise after several centuries of a world order led by the West, a Tianxia order or Tianxiaism, Tianxiazhui, that has its origins in traditional China should be deemed a fresh resource for replacing the world order that has been in place since the early modern period. Ge points out that these scholars argue that on a philosophical level, the Confucian world is a world without borders, one without the distinctions of inner and outer, us and them. It is a world in which all people are treated equally. Accordingly, the Tianxia order should be used to replace the current world order. He warns that if this kind of thinking is not stripped of its core of nationalism, which sees China as the centre of Tianxia, and its attitude of arrogant self-regard, then it can easily become a new form of chauvinism that claims to have universal relevance under the cover of representations such as equality of the multitude of states and all in the four seas are one family. Ge is also critical of some of the more radical mainland New Confucians, which includes members of the Kung clique, contributors to the publication What is Universal, Whose Values? Contemporary Confucians Discuss Universal Values, as well as contributors to a range of other publications, including the 2016 volume China Must Re-Confucianize, New Proposals by Mainland New Confucians. The fact that a scholar of Ge Zhaoguang's prominent standing in the academic community should devote a 33,000 Chinese character essay to critiquing their views underscores the growing influence of this conservative yet extremely nationalistic group of ideologues. In the essay, he describes how mainland New Confucians feel that to acknowledge universal values is to succumb to westernization and amounts to self-barbarization. He points out that the idea of barbarization is an extremely strong accusation because it elevates the distinction between Chinese and barbarian from that of differences in values to a clash between the civilized and the uncivilized, or even places races and cultures in absolute opposition. Again, I underscore that the distinction between Chinese and barbarian is very much central to the traditional Tianxia discourse. Ge also discerns a huge change in the intellectual orientation of so-called mainland New Confucians since the 1980s. He characterizes this change as moving from a perspective of searching for points of commonality between traditional Chinese Confucian thought and modern Western universal values to one of striving to establish clear boundaries between Chinese thought and Western values. The introduction to the volume, What is Universal, Whose Values? Contemporary Confucians Discuss Universal Values, not only illustrates this point, but also highlights mainland New Confucians' criticisms of earlier generations of Confucians, or so-called modern New Confucians, the Xiandai Xinrujia, such as Liang Shuming, Ma Yifu, Xiong Shili, Xu Fuguan, Tang Xuyi, Mo Zongsan. These are all very important people in 20th century Confucianism or Confucian intellectual tradition of the 20th century. The authors of the introduction to that volume describe how Confucian values were universal. Confucian values were universal until the late Qing period, the early 20th century, when they were displaced by Western universal values. They further insist that it was not just misguided Chinese intellectuals after the May 4th period who were to blame for this displacement. They claim that it was also the fault of conservative Confucians who affirmed only those Confucian values that were compatible with, or at least did not contradict, Western universal values. This criticism of major Confucian thinkers such as Liang Shuming, Ma Yifu, and Xiong Shili also highlights an ideological rift between the mainland New Confucians and more mainstream Confucian supporters such as Chen Lai. In espousing a universalism with Chinese or Confucian-based characteristics, Chen Lai clearly regards himself to be a follower in the footsteps of a number of major 20th century Chinese pioneers. Consider Chen's following comments on Ma Yifu's version of Guoxue, or national learning, which Ma referred to as the six arts. Chen writes, Maifu was a conservative who differed from other conservatives in that he championed universalism rather than particularism. His conception of the six arts is not the same as our understanding today that the six arts are merely the expression of one culture. Rather, he understood them to have a truly global significance and that all of the world's cultures should be brought into this system to be evaluated because it is a universalist system. So in his system, the tradition of the six arts could incorporate Western culture into a more rational framework, which would constitute a universal framework. Of course, Ma had a conservative attitude, but his universalist attitude does not simply affirm Western culture. On the contrary, it brings Western learning into the Chinese system of learning. He felt that Western learning was not universal enough and that ours is more universal. What Chen Lai omits in this account, however, is that Ma was very much a syncretist, in which Buddhist thought was no less central to his philosophical agenda. In commenting on Liang Shuming's major early work, Eastern and Western Cultures and Their Philosophies, Chen Lai summarises what he sees as Liang Shuming's principal cultural vision. He writes, Liang Shuming's thinking was that, at the time, the first thing that needed to be confronted was the need for all-round acceptance of Western culture, but that this was nothing more than a pragmatic decision, because closely following on from this, there would be the renaissance of Chinese culture, and after that would follow the renaissance of Indian culture. This formulation did not amount to saying that the affirmation of Confucianism as the next stage of Chinese culture was simply to draw forth Western values. On the contrary, his understanding of Western culture was that the West could advance no further than it was at the time, and that what must lie ahead was the realization of Confucian values. Again, what Chen Lai omits in this account is that Liang Shuming further maintained that Chinese culture itself had not developed to a stage that would enable it to enter a Buddhist cultural period, unlike India, and so Liang promoted Confucian moral values as a necessary preparatory stage on the path to Buddhism, a sort of expedient means, an empire. Further, Chen fails to dwell on the fact that Liang also developed his own versions of Yogacara Buddhist philosophy as an intellectual foundation for his own philosophy of culture. Indeed, throughout his life, Liang did not relinquish his personal commitment to Buddhism, even though his philosophy of culture argued for the relative merits of Confucianism and indeed later Marxism for Chinese culture at its particular stage of cultural development. Even more so than either Ma Yifu or Liang Shuming, it is Xiong Shili whom Chen Lai holds in the highest intellectual esteem. This is especially evident in Chen's book, Humaneness-Based Ontology. Indeed, Chen is quite explicit in his emulation of what he characterises as Xiong's Confucian Ti-Yung ontology. I won't go into the nitty-gritty of that, but yet Xiong's Ti-Yung ontology was principally shaped by Buddhist ideas. Chen Lai, however, again silences the Buddhist dimension of Xiong's thought. This is symptomatic. This silencing of the Buddhist dimension is symptomatic of a much more insidious and quite pervasive cultural self-censoring evident in the modern Chinese academy, in which Confucianism is typically presented as an expression of a native system of ideas developed independent of external cultural influences over 2,000 years. Confucianism is privileged as the true representation of Chinese cultural ideals and values and an integral part of traditional Chinese society and cultural identity. Buddhism is excluded on the grounds that it is a foreign import, despite having first been introduced into China 2,000 years ago and subsequently having shaped the development of indigenous Chinese traditions, religion, philosophy, art, literature, and we can go on. This privileging of Confucianism feeds an assumption that Chinese philosophy is a hermetically sealed tradition or set of traditions that can be understood and adjudicated only by reference to its own internal norms and premises. But to regard Confucianism this way is to ignore the vital contribution that Buddhist thought has made to the intellectual composition of Chinese philosophy. Protagonists of Chinese Confucianism tend to ignore or downplay the influence of Buddhism on the development of Confucian thought and philosophy, but the evidence tells quite a different story. Buddhism provided new Confucian thinkers These are the 20th century New Confucian thinkers. With the conceptual such, and I'm thinking particularly of thinkers such as Xiong Shili and Mo Zhong San, with the conceptual tools to develop the most creative ontologies and epistemologies in modern Chinese philosophy. It is thus perplexing that the philosophical resources of Sinitic Buddhism continue to be so undervalued in the modern Chinese academy. It is moreover ironic that those who complain most bitterly about the externally imposed hegemonic practices continue to perpetuate other kinds of hegemonic regimes from within. Chen Lai creatively appropriated Zhu Xi's philosophy to make the virtue or the value of humaneness the foundation not only of Confucian values, but also the universal values of freedom, equality, and justice. This, without doubt, is an exercise in hybridization, albeit a highly reductionist and politically calculated hybridization. We will have to see whether an ideological cocktail of Confucian and core socialist values will provide the right formula for a future Tianxia world order. What might this sort of Tianxia world look like? Guo Zhaoguang warns of the following scenario if the concept of Tianxia is brought to life. When imagined versions of the tribute system is an important part of the Tianxia system, are taken to be real and memories of the celestial empire are unearthed, then perhaps Chinese culture and national sentiment will turn into a nationalism or statism that opposes both global civilization and regional cooperation. Such a development would truly lead to a clash of civilizations. Or is the future already here? In a recent article published in the influential journal Foreign Affairs, sociologist Salvatore Babones describes what he calls the American Tianxia. Let me conclude the presentation with a description of the dystopian Brave New World that he conjures up. Today, the United States is at the center of a global Tianxia. This American Tianxia is much more than a state or country or even an empire. It pervades all areas of life. In today's connected world, Chinese businessmen, Russian universities, and even Iranian revolutions are run on American lines. The Islamic State, ISIS, recommends that its fighters use Android devices, whereas North Korea's ruling Kim family famously prefers Apple. Many people around the world oppose the United States, its policies, and its president, but they still want to send their children to American universities, invest their money in American companies, and express their opinions on American social networks. This is not some kind of consumerism run amok. Standing at the center of the global order, the United States has, over the last quarter century, reorientated the world, and particularly the world's elite, works, plays, and thinks. It has brought them into an international hierarchy in which gaining status requires succeeding within US-centered networks and playing by US rules. And it makes 21st century America more powerful than any empire, kingdom, or commonwealth in history. The United States, that is, the country itself, has plenty of hard and soft power. But the United States has limits. The American Tianxia does not. Thank you.